Well, first of all, thank you all for coming tonight. I know there was another event over in Simi Valley may have heard of, but thank you for being here. I would have liked to have had a few more students here. I'm actually on paternity leave, so I was unable to force my students to be here, so this is sometimes what you get. So I'm going to try and set the stage here and then allow each of the panelists to sort of bring their experience to bear on the questions tonight. So it's more than 33 years after its passage, Proposition 13's legacy and impact remains much contested territory. Joe Matthews has written that Proposition 13 created a new operating system for California politics, one that has led us down the path of an endless loop leading to a crash. Peter Schrag saw Proposition 13 as the end of the New Deal, ushering in the Reagan revolution of deregulation and low taxes. Others have written about Prop 13 as a victory of small property over big government, affording property owners certainty about their tax bill and limiting the reach of big government. And yet, one of the great ironies of Proposition 13 is that an initiative intended to drive a stake through the heart of big government ended up empowering big government. In one fell swoop, Proposition 13 transformed the local property tax into a statewide revenue source. The impact has been particularly felt in the area of school governance, with California effectively operating a state-funded school system. In addition to creating more big government, Proposition 13 has also seemed to have increased the influence of special interests, particularly corporations and unions, with Sacramento their preferred destination for one-stop shopping. And perhaps above all, Proposition 13 led to a new industry in governing the state by initiative, simultaneously increasing the power of special interests and further placing state government in a fiscal straitjacket. Finally, critics say that Prop 13's supermajority requirements for raising revenues have resulted in the tyranny of the minority, grossly amplifying the power of legislative minorities and distorting the democratic process. In short, for critics, Proposition 13 is the boogeyman of California politics, responsible for much of what ails the state. For supporters, it has single-handedly saved the American dream for millions of California property owners from the clutches of big government. Tonight we'll discuss Prop 13's legacy, and in particular whether reform of this controversial initiative is necessary or even possible in light of the current economic conditions. So with that said, I'm going to hand it over to Harvey, and he's going to take us back to the 70s. And give us a flavor of what the climate was like.
Let me begin. 1977-78, California certainly was a very different place. But let's take a look at the perspective of it from one homeowner, a 65-year-old widow. We bought her house in 1962 for some $16,000. And in house was probably worth about $22,000 to $25,000 in 1978, maybe 30. This widow had a bookkeeping job. She had a mortgage payment of $212 a month. She had a property tax bill of $1,000 a year. So basically 5 months of her mortgage payment was her property tax bill. She lived in fear every year when she wandered around the neighborhood or even walks and see homes for sale, because she knew that as homes were sold at the new inflated price of $25,000 to $35,000 in the Pico Robertson neighborhood that she lived, that her property tax bill was going to go up. And her salary at Libby Penn Company, right here on Laurel Canyon Boulevard, 7250 North Laurel Canyon Boulevard, that salary would go up maybe $5 to $10 a week, once or twice a year. But how does this person continue to live in their house? That's what 1977-78 was like for a significant number of homeowners. I can recite those numbers so precisely because that's my mother that I'm talking about. The Howard Jarvis came along, who was the executive director of the Apartment Association, and he had tried 5 or 6 times to qualify what became Proposition 13 on the ballot, failed each time to gather the number of signatures. When he found a compatriot in Northern California, Paul Gann, who, you know, people forget it was called the Jarvis Gann Initiative. Jarvis had greater longevity and better public relations consultants than Gann now Jarvis and Chicago. They teamed up together between them. They were able to get the signatures on me. As I recall, I believe Prop 13 was only about seven sentences long. And I joined the firm that ran the Jarvis campaign, Prop 13, about a month after Prop 13 passed. And so I did run Prop 13, but I spent the next 2.5 years of my life traveling around the world with Howard Jarvis. So I had a pretty good idea of what Howard Jarvis' thinking was and where Howard Jarvis wanted to go. I also want to remind you that the June 1978 ballot, Proposition 8 was put on the ballot. As is often the case in politics and government, every action causes a ridiculously poorly drafted reaction. The Prop 8 was very interesting. It was overwhelmingly supported by the Democratic establishment. It was overwhelmingly supported by Republicans in the legislature. And it was completely funded by the business community. And the key feature of Proposition 8 was a split role, that homeowners would be taxed at a lower rate than businesses. Prop 8 failed. Obviously, Prop 13 passed with a two-thirds margin. Howard Jarvis's goal was protecting residential property, whether it was homeowners or renters, and certainly the people who owned apartment buildings, because they passed their property tax along to the renters. So, in some way, when they could, and as we all know, economics, you can't always do that. So, Howard Jarvis was never, in fact, he was probably a Republican populist, is what we would call it today. I don't think he'd be a Tea Party member, because maybe he would, but Howard Jarvis didn't love big corporations. He was a guy who really cared about individuals. And his goal for Prop 13 was protecting residential property. And in conversations that Howard had, and there are only about a half dozen of us left in California who actually worked with Howard Jarvis and knew Howard Jarvis. I enjoy hearing all these people invoking Howard Jarvis's name. As we all probably read in Los Angeles Times this morning, all the people invoking Ronald Reagan's name, who don't stand for anything that Ronald Reagan was able to do. But Howard Jarvis was no fan of corporate interests. And I think that in our conversations over the years, 2.5 years, I've traveled with him. I traveled with Howard to Europe twice. I traveled with him to about 30 states. I created a media event for Howard Jarvis, done tea in Boston Harbor in the New American Tax Revolution. I was with Howard when he was on the cover of Time magazine, helped arrange that, so I spent a lot of time with him. I can tell you, Howard Jarvis always said that someday Prop 13 will need to be updated. I'm one of those people that believe that we're probably beyond the day, and today may even be too late, but the Prop 13 does need to be updated. Howard's topic for, I have my thoughts, which we'll probably get into this evening perhaps, but there does needs to be an update, because just a simple figure that that you may know that I came across just the other day, aside from some of the administrative changes that we made with Prop 13, that wouldn't take legislature much to do, but in the residential in Los Angeles County, the share of residential property ownership was. Los Angeles County residential property tax went from 53% to 69% over the last 32 years of all property taxes paid. Contra Costa County, for example, went from 48% to 73%. That was never Howard Jarvis's intent, that commercial property would be taxed at a far lesser rate than residential.
Let's see, Joe, do you want to take it from there?
Sure. let me try to there's a good history, but let me try to go back before, to when the story of Prop 13 really starts, 13 years before Prop 13. Now, does anyone in this room know who Russell Wolden was? That may mean nothing. Well, Russell Wolden is really the father of Prop 13. Russell Wolden was the assessor in San Francisco, 1965. This is back in the glorious days when assessors, when assessments mattered, when your assessor came around and assessed your property, and your local government, local elected officials set property taxes. And Mr. Walden had a side business doing some business consulting, and it turned out that corporations that hired his business had much lower assessments and ultimately paid less in property taxes than those who did not. And when a whistleblower revealed this in 1965, people began to look at the conduct of assessors, who are elected officials all over the state of California, and found that there was similar corruption across the state. In fact, that when the San Diego assessor was found out, he sort of dramatically killed himself in 1966. Now, there were attempts to deal with this scandal in the legislature, and the legislation ultimately passed by a governor named, and supported by a governor named Brown, took away all the discretion that these assessors had had at elected officials and how they decided on things. And instead imposed a rule that the property taxes would be based on 25% of the market value that would be the value at which things were assessed. And that essentially created kind of an autopilot system, replacing the discretion of these elected officials. And what happened, what turned out with this new formula that we imposed, and that's a very California thing to do, to solve a problem with a formula, is it turned out that these assessors, in addition to a lot of them being corrupt, had used their discretion, because they were elected officials, to protect voters, homeowners, and had actually, in general, corporations had paid a little more. So when the homeowners lost the benefit of this sort of political democratic protection, and things got on a formula, properties soared. There was no more of this protection, and thus you had this crisis, which led to the problems of this widow. Walden was so notorious that he became known and is sort of forever known, for those who are old enough to do this or read the histories, as the crooked assessor. So what does Prop 13 mean? You can talk about the three parts of it, the limit, the property tax part, the 1%, and limits on how much things can go up, and reassessment. You can talk about the two-thirds rule for the for raising revenues in the legislature, which was a big move, and we don't talk nearly enough about the way it sort of was the beginning of stripping the authority of our local elected officials to set tax rates, and the basic political and spending discipline that created that cost us, and the centralization. I mean, Prop 13 was really a great centralizer, as Tom alluded to in his statement. You can talk about all of those things. But really what Prop 13, I think, represents was something that's been part of our culture before Prop 13 and has become more and more of our culture now, which is our way of solving problems in this state is to put a formula in place, to take it out of the realm of political choice, of elected officials making decisions, and to impose a formula. And we've done this, everyone's done this. It's not just right-wing folks in the Howard Jarvis Tax Association, which people love to praise or rail against. You know, the teachers' unions have done this with school funding, and you start to, you take apart the budget, and there's formula after formula after formula, and the people who don't have special formulas or special protections, higher education, some, programs that benefit poor folks, get hammered and hammered again and again. But it's a game of formulas, and there are so many formulas now in our system that we can't manage our system. I mean, it's essentially, there's a theory that some technology people have that, when as artificial intelligence becomes more and more, high level, as systems, technological systems become more and more complicated, there's a point of sometimes a theory of singularity where the machine becomes more so complicated that we can't manage it. It's smarter than us. And some people feel at some point, there were a few movies made by the former governor of California on this principle, the machines eventually will turn and kill us. Well, in California, we have, through all of these formulas, and Prop 13 is the biggest one, we have a sort of budget singularity. A system that we can't manage, it's too complicated. And that really comes from Prop 13. And one of the great ironies is while Prop 13 is often discussed and talked of as this great triumph of of democracy. It's actually quite the opposite. This taking of discretion and power out of the hands of the people we elect, out of human beings, and putting it into math, into formulas, is profoundly anti-democratic. It makes the formulas the masters of us. And it also has the effect of creating a very heavy dead hand in the state. I mean, that widow that Harvey talked about is many things, and it's, you know, was a sympathetic character, but I can tell you one thing about her now, and that is she is dead, and has probably been dead for quite some time. But yet her political needs continue to govern our taxation system in the state, how we fund schools, and that is makes California a profoundly different place. The best governed states in this country, the states that that we look to as examples of how to manage budgets, places like Virginia, Indiana, even Wisconsin, have none of these kinds of formulas, none of these sort of rules on taxes and spending written into their constitutions. They didn't go down this sort of path of machines and formulas that Prop 13 took us down. Instead, but we did, and the result is that we are profoundly governed by ghosts in the state. We are still talking about the needs, and it's still relevant, the particular needs of, you know, of all elderly homeowners in 1978, time of high inflation, in the world of 2011. That's nuts. That's the core of the problem. Why should the taxes that I pay, if I'm in escrow in a house now in the San Gabriel Valley, why should those have been determined by voters in 1978 when I was five? Why should decisions, you know, about the funding of the schools that my children, 2.5 and 7 months old, are going to go to in a couple of years, why should those have been governed by decisions made by voters in 1988 when we passed Prop 98, when I was 15? That's not democratic. We need to unwind not just Prop 13, but all of these whips and chains and formulas that have really become a sort of prison we live in and have robbed us of the ability and the responsibility and the accountability of making decisions for ourselves and then living with them. We don't have that opportunity. And I think, you know, to me, Prop 13 is sort of the operating base, you know, along with some things that came before it and a lot of things that have come after it, that really have us in this fix, that keep us in chains.
Roberto Verde.
I'm going to try to bring it around to what's probably the lightest thing on the table, which is the issue of split roll. And I've been an advocate for split roll since 1978. 78, I was a high school student. I was a senior. And I was very politically involved with that and looked at the issues and while I completely understood the issue of holding property taxes on residential property, my parents owned a home. And at 17, with parents that, well, my father that was limited English speaking, had explained to him the property tax bill and why it was going up every year. So I understood that and supported a freezing of property taxes upon homeowners. But I didn't understand, being educated, I didn't understand why it reached into covering everybody. Commercial property owners, rental properties, industrial properties, retail properties, I couldn't understand that. So I engaged with a number of students on my campus to basically oppose Prop 13. We actually even planned a walkout. And I went to school in Orange County. So Orange County at that time was a big hotbed of support for Prop 13. Here I am basically organizing a 3,000 student campus to go walk out and march to City Hall, and students opposing it. My principal found out, called all of us organizers into his conference room and basically told us that if we brought the students off the campus, he would tell our respective colleges and universities that accepted us into our we were seniors into college the next year, that what we had done. And being somewhat intelligent, all of us basically were appropriately scared and backed off. And just stood back and continued individually to oppose Prop 13, but didn't take our 3,000 students with us to the City Hall. And that was in 1978. The thing about it is that And I currently represent an organization that serves about 6,000 businesses a year. Probably most of them renters, not property owners. About the same time, we have a program where we actually help property owners buy real estate, called SBA 504. And so we do that. And so we work with a lot of business owners. And we do a lot of business lending. We do a lot of business consulting. And the fact is that as we look at the whole split role issue, and as an organization, we're not an advocacy organization, we're services. We do analysis. We help businesses deal with the realities of running a business, particularly now in this current, you know, kind of end of recession, maybe recovery, maybe a recession, financial crisis, et cetera. And the fact is that, one, any kind of change in Prop 13 will negatively affect property owners, commercial property owners, developers, et cetera. It will. It will cause an increase in cost. There's no argument about that. At the same time, and I'm not even going to begin to basically talk about how our legislature does a lousy job of distributing dollars. That's a whole other discussion, and we can't even begin to justify or argue that point. But, you know, my assistant, Anita Patel, did a great job for me over the past few days kind of putting together research in terms of all the issues around split role. And the number of studies that have been done recently in terms of how Prop 13, you know, any change in Prop 13 would affect businesses. And it's frankly frightening about how much of the research and studies and advocacy against changing Prop 13 is all about job loss and business loss. And most of it is crap. Most of it is junk. Because the fact is that yes, is there going to be a negative impact to property owners and developers? Yes, there is. But to the businesses and the business community, whether it's mom and pop shop that I currently provide financing to on the corner, or a company like Silmar has 150 employees, the impact of a split role is going to be nominal. There's not going to be job loss to businesses that I work with. Okay? And let's remember, most property owners and developers don't create jobs. Most cases, it's the tenants in their buildings that create jobs, not themselves. And this is an ongoing dialogue I have with people at the LA Business Journal, et cetera. It is the tenants who create the jobs. It's the businesses that occupy that space, or maybe the businesses that actually buy that building who actually create jobs. It's not the developers themselves, you know, the owners themselves. They don't. And yes, they will be negatively impacted by Prop 13. That's a given. Fact is, the rent for most businesses is somewhere between 5 and 10%. Anything above 10%, we will tell a business owner they're paying too much rent. And at 10%, it's usually a retail restaurant with 5 or 10,000 square feet of space. Most cases, probably closer to 5%, which is probably an industrial business or a service business that has a number of employees producing a product or providing a service. So rent is a portion of their total business expense. It is not a portion, the biggest portion of any business expense, as you probably know, is payroll. That's the portion. So things like workers' compensation, health benefits, those things that, and payroll taxes, that has a bigger effect on a business's viability than necessarily their rent. Again, 5 to 10% of a business expense is their rent. So let's put this whole discussion about business expense and job loss into perspective. My organization owns a building. We bought it in 2001 for $3.1 million. We bought a building. Today that building is estimated to be worth, it went to 7 probably in 2006, now it's back to maybe 5. My property tax in my building right now is probably about $30,000 a year, give or take. A exemption of our building from Prop 13 would result in our property taxes going up probably up to $50,000 a year. $20,000 increase in my property taxes, on a yearly basis. I don't like that. That's probably a $10,000 cost to my organization directly. Okay? At the same time, but my tenants, the people who actually rent for me, my typical tenant, 1,000 square feet, paying $2 a square foot, we're probably looking at a $1,000 expense during the entire year for based upon a triple net, and I don't do triple net, I do gross, so let's talk about that too. Remember, some businesses are paid on a gross basis, which includes property taxes, some pay on triple net, which doesn't include property taxes. Mine are gross, so they're not gonna see anything. I'm not going to increase my rent above market. My rent's already at market. I'm not going to increase my rent above market because I might lose that tenant. I mean, again, somebody mentioned here, you know, you mentioned earlier, it's also a question of market. You know, the fact is that, and I know very few commercial property owners who may have owned a building for a long period of time who have kept their rents at 1978 levels. They've increased it with market. They've increased it with inflation. So their property taxes may not have increased to market, but I'm sure their rents have. And I'm sure that any of their tenants have not basically enjoyed the fact that property taxes are lower. I'm just simply talking reality. The fact is that my tenants who may be looking at, say, a rent expense of 5 to 8% of their business expense may not look at a rent expense of maybe 7 to 8.5, 9% of their expense. Nominal. Okay? Not enough to cost them one job. So the studies that I've been looking at, and pull them all out, that this increase in property tax is going to cost jobs. Rent is not, in most cases, not a big enough portion of their business expense to cost jobs. Not when 85% of the businesses in Los Angeles, some 300,000 businesses, are businesses with employees of less than 25. And for the $10,000 that I may have to basically pay more in property taxes, $10,000 to $20,000 I may have to pay more in property taxes, the fact is that the businesses I work with are more concerned about, do we have sufficient police protection? Do we have sufficient fire services? Do we have street paving with all the potholes in the front of Van Nuys Boulevard in front of my building? Do we have transportation improvements that allow me to get to my work within a reasonable amount of time? And lastly, schools. And one of the biggest complaints I hear from business people, small and medium-sized business people, is a workforce that isn't literate, computer-ready, or able to basically take a job. Again, I'm not trying to argue that our school districts, and that's a whole other discussion for a whole different time, are effective. I mean, if you want to talk about splitting up LAUSD, it's a whole separate discussion I'm happy to be part of too. But the fact is that one of the biggest complaints that I have from my business people is a workplace-ready workforce. And lastly, and it was funny. I mean, I'm looking at a study, and somebody uses Disneyland as a great example of what would happen if you increase Disneyland's property tax. I mean, Disneyland is looking at property taxes. They bought the property in 1955. They haven't sold it, obviously. And their property taxes have been governed by Prop 13 year after year after year. I would love to see that the ticket prices of Disneyland have been commensurate with Prop 13. Obviously they're not. I hold 4 annual passes to Disneyland. It cost me $235 each. The fact is that, these property owners, have not, I have not seen any level of discount price control because of Prop 13. Things are still based upon market, whether it's ticket prices at Disneyland or whether it's a can of Budweiser beer. And the fact is that, to talk about job loss, to talk about business loss from increasing Prop 13 is not a valid argument. Do we want to talk about increased cost to property owners and developers? Yes, okay, fine, let's have that discussion. And the great thing about the initiative process is whoever spends the most wins, usually. And that will probably be the battle. But to basically try to equate, in a time when jobs are such a big thing, 12% unemployment in California is a big thing. But to talk about split roll as basically being having some type of impact on the unemployment rate is simply a bogus argument.
I can also add, exactly, I completely agree with what was just said in terms of virtually everything. My office downtown Los Angeles, kind of more of a high rise. My firm has half a floor. We're on a triple net lease. Our monthly rent is about $25,000 a month. And based upon every formula that we've looked at, that we've heard about, because of the split roll of any kind, the most our property taxes will go up is $250 a month. That doesn't have a major effect on our company. My firm has grown from 10 people to 16 people this year without benefits of you know, government tax breaks or any kinds of subsidy. You can do it through hard work. You know, that's the way it should go. But absolutely right. I think you were eloquent in simplifying it so that anybody can understand that any kind of a split role, however informing it might be, will not have an effect on business operations. It is really a pretty dishonest method that people who don't want to see California reform are using.
Harvey, let me pick up on something that you said earlier. That I learned a lot from your history of hanging out with Howard Jarvis through Europe. I'm sure there are more stories there. But you know, you mentioned that Howard Jarvis would probably not support Proposition 13 in its current form, or that he believed it needed to be updated. How would you, could you divine how would Howard Jarvis reform Prop 13 today? And then could you give us the position of the organization called the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association and have a conversation between Howard Jarvis and the people who now run the organization?
I don't know what Howard would support today. I mean, we never talk about how it would need to be reformed or my phrase updated, his phrase updated. I sat down over the last 6 months with a number of people, some county assessors and former county assessors around the state, some people who are very adept at writing ballot initiatives, and we've looked at almost every single way that you could enact and update a Prop 13. We came up with some administrative ones that actually Tom Elias talked about in a recent column. We talked about, they're just administrative things that could be done. If you bring substantial dollars to state government, for example, if the corporation sells its property and only sells 49%, the property doesn't get reassessed. So there are lots of companies out there that have gone through this, lots of commercial properties that could be reassessed. We looked at it, and we haven't run all the numbers officially, but we think that we look at something like taxing commercial property at 1.5%, keeping residential property at 1%. While I agree with Joe on many things in terms of initiative budgeting that's gone on in California and the problems with it, I'm also a pragmatist. I've been in the business of politics for 41 years, and I understand, 43 years, I'm getting old, we're never going to get rid of all of the things on the ballot. We couldn't even get our government to host a constitutional convention to look at everything that needs to be done that Bob Hertzberg and others wanted to do. So I think one of the simpler ways of doing it, one that brings revenue to the state of California, one that does not cause any harm to the business entities that create jobs in the district in California, is tax commercial property 1.5%, keep the same structures and strictures that are in Prop 13 there, keep residential property at 1% the way it is now, and move forward with perhaps a look forward and look back every 10 years. That, coupled with administrative changes, probably brings anywhere from, on the low side, probably $5 billion to the state, and the high side, maybe as much as $15 to $18 billion annually to the state, without causing any real pain. Now, in terms of how the Howard Jarvis tax reduction movement, which is comprised of people primarily, except for two, never met Howard Jarvis, never knew Howard Jarvis, sort of like the guy who runs the Tea Party, Robert Norquist, who never created a job, but they speak about jobs all day long. Their answer is very simple. No change. You can't change it. Well, you know, everything requires change. You know, the Constitution has a number of amendments starting with 10, the variety of that changes since then. It used to be said that Social Security was the third rail of American politics. You couldn't change it. Well, we are tinkering and have been tinkering with Social Security. And updating and tinkering a Prop 13 is past due. But the businesses which opposed Proposition 13 in 1978 now wear it as a sacred shawl on Yom Kippur, a sacred talisman on Yom Kippur, that cannot be taken off. And I think that I completely agree in terms of what we have to do in terms of our infrastructure updating, in terms of our educational system, and probably we're going to have lots of debates about good and bad in the educational system and what can be done, how government doing things wrong. But we need to have more revenue coming in, and we need to have people who have received the unbelievable, the largesse of the law that was never intended to give them this kind of tax rate.
Joe, I want to ask a question of you. In your book, California Crackup, like half of your setup is about Prop 13. You know, it's a really important part of what you guys talk about in your book. And I think one of the more interesting discussions in there for me was the discussion about why two-thirds? How is that justifiable? Two-thirds. And so yeah. Talk about this, the two-thirds requirement and how you and your co-author think that it doesn't quite fit in with the concept of democracy.
Well, I mean two-thirds is nothing holy or unholy about two-thirds. Two-thirds is if you want two-thirds vote, you're looking, you know, that's a principle of, you know, consensus. You want a very broad consensus to do something with two-thirds. And Prop 13 didn't invent two-thirds for fiscal decisions in the state. I mean, that actually happened in 1933 in the midst of a really bad economic time. There was something called the Stuart-Riley Amendment, which said that for non-school expenditures, you needed a two-thirds vote if the budget were to go up by more than 5%. In the 60s, when we had a constitutional revision commission in the state, whose files I had to read through a very long couple months, the 5% piece came out of it. And it was because it was, that was a, they were trying to make the Constitution shorter and take out things that were considered non-controversial. And no one thought very much of it, so little that it's not, was not anywhere in, when voters approved the constitutional revisions, it was not mentioned anywhere in election count. So that's where we got two-thirds for the budget. So, you know, two-thirds to spend, two-thirds to tax, there was sort of a something there. But that's that requires a very broad consensus in, when you impose two-thirds, and Prop 13 and the Stuart-Riley Amendment sort of set two-thirds is the standard. Now you need two-thirds to do anything really different with education spending, because that's what Prop 98 says. We got rid of two-thirds for the budget through Prop 25, but we added a new two-thirds rule that applies to other kinds of revenues on the same ballot a year ago. The other basic problem with two-thirds is that, you know, in a consensus-based, you know, some would say minority rule type system, which you can make an argument for in a place that's really diverse like this, is that our election system is not based on the same principle. We elect people in the most majoritarian kind of elections in the world, the American British system, where, you know, what our elections are about. We have single member districts, we have plurality elections, and that's a system that's used to take a small number of votes, a very small percentage of people actually elect folks in the office, and turn that into a majority that has political legitimacy. That's one operating principle. So you elect people in this system to create a majority party, and then you put them into this consensus-based system, which for making all the tough decisions on fiscal stuff. And those things don't match. Those things don't fit together. So, you know, all the arguments in California we hear in political campaigns about this bad person, this bad interest group. I mean, the core problem with California is you're putting together two kinds of systems with different values. So you either need a very different kind of election system, or if you're like the way elections are, you need to move to a system that's more majoritarian. And I think, given, you know, the fact that, you know, where people are politically, where the parties are, you know, we're it's not just, you know, our politicians, but voters themselves are more polarized. And there's this LA Times USC poll that showed, you know, people, both majorities of Democrats and Republicans, don't want the people who represent them to compromise, that a consensus-based system makes no sense in this kind of system. And unfortunately, you know, and what we need is a system where the partisans take turns and they're clearly accountable for the decisions they make. that would sort of fit much better. Unfortunately, there's very little conversation about doing that, and we have a governor, we have a president who, I mean, this frustrates me, you know, who spend, you know, over and over again, and this is sort of, and sort of the media narrative, woe is us, all these people, they just can't get along. Well, you know, I mean, yeah, because they see the world differently. So, you know, a system that forces people who can't get along to get along is not, in my mind, a very good system. And I say that as a decline of state moderate. I mean, I wish everyone was moderate. You know, we moderates, it's true what you hear. We're smarter, we're better looking than most other folks, but there aren't many of us left. So we have to, you know, let these partisans take their turns in systems that where one party is clearly in charge, and if they screw up and things don't well, we have systems that allow the other party to take back power.
Roberto, you sort of have a pulse on the business community, particularly small business here in the Valley. How do they see Proposition 13? Is this an issue that's on their minds? And if so, how would your average small to medium-sized business person in the Valley propose reforming Prop 13?
I mean, first of all, they're going to be concerned about their own property, their own home. That's going to be their first reaction. Are they going to change my home property taxes? Once you get beyond the discussion about home, then the differentiation between, you know, maybe 20% of them who actually own their building, what they mean, and the 80% who don't. And the 20% who do, how is it going to affect my, you know, the property that I currently own? And the 80% that don't, how is it going to affect my rent, if that? And with all the, I mean, we had a tough time online trying to find any, you know, non-scare article on Prop 13. I mean, the amount of Google, you know, support for, you know, foot rolling was like, we found zero. We found lots of people, Caltex, a bunch of other, you know, people throwing on, you know, how this is going to kill businesses, how it's going to cost jobs, and how we're going to do all of that. So, I mean, a lot of the scare out there is, you know, being targeted at small business. The folks that would say no would like small business to think. And right now, and that's the only real ammunition. We want small businesses to think, small business owners to think that it's going to basically cause massive costs to their business. And it's going to cost jobs. And, you know, of course, right now, what's the biggest issue here in California? Unemployment and job creation. And this is all of a sudden going to basically make it even worse. So, I mean, getting past all that, right now, businesses are concerned about sales. Businesses are concerned about consumer confidence. Businesses are concerned about the possibility of a next recession. Businesses are concerned that, you know what, my sales are down, you know, 25% still from, you know, 2007 and haven't recovered. And at what point are people going to start spending money? So beyond someone who may look at the issue, right now it's not a big thing on people's radar. Right now people's radar is, you know, how do we get some level of certainty in this economy? Because we have none. I mean, you know, I think there's a 50% chance we get into a double-digit recession. And right now, most economists are looking at 35% chance back into another recession. That's what small businesses are concerned about. So, you know, I think as we, if the discussion continues to get any level of speed, then it might be a more concern. But, you know, if I'm looking at, you know, at 25% sales drop, you know, 5%, 6% increase in my rent, it doesn't pick up a lot of space.
I just want to jump in because, I mean, those are very good points, and I like that you're talking about the present and what people are facing now, because it's bizarre. You know, Vera Gosa raised this whole issue of Prop 13, and we've fallen into one of these sort of arguments about Prop 13, which are like 1978 and the holiness and the politics of it, and it's sort of totally divorced from this really urgent reality, which is we live in California, which is in the middle of a, you know, very bad economic time, and the source of that, those problems, are tied in all sorts of different kinds of ways to housing in California. You know, I mean, it's like we're talking about this thing and missing the big thing in front of our noses. And, you know, I don't see in the sort of the media conversation, the public conversation, league conversation, any connection to, you know, maybe this is a moment to think differently about, you know, about things like, you know, about housing. I mean, they're you know, the problem now is not 1978. We do not have exploding home values in the state. Thank God, it's allowed you know ruffians like me into the housing market. We have declining prices, and that it's a crisis. It's a core part of our jobs issue, where the state is actually doing better than the national average and across all these kinds of sectors and jobs, but it's getting killed in things that relate to housing, construction, and government. And you know, if we had flexibility, if we didn't make this holy writ, you know, we could have conversations about what to do about that. And that, you know, and you know, I mean, I've heard, you know, occasionally come across a good idea. Maybe we could cut property taxes for new buyers, you know, in the immediate term to try to get the housing market going again, but in the short term, but in the long term allow assessments to be higher so that the government shares in greater gains in the future. I mean, but that kind of conversation is not happening. We instead want to talk about this thing, this construct, this formula from 1978. And that way, Prop 13 represents a real myopia in California. That's really, you know, that I think is the real problem.
Well, I think it's gotten even worse, to be honest with you, with the era of term limits, where we now have elected officials on almost every level of government, every significant level of government, the city of Los Angeles, the Los Angeles State Legislature, that they no longer have to be really accountable for the actions that they take. I always believe in the laws of natural selection when it comes to term limits, and that is throw the bumps out if they do a bad job. And that's elections are for, elections are natural term limits. And so what we now have is a class of politicians who refuse to have an inability to look at long-term solutions and to be absolutely creative in these solutions. Of how to get things done. We are finishing a legislative session in Sacramento on Friday. They are ramming through bills like crazy, and bills such as whether signature gatherers for petitions should wear signs saying "Pay signature gatherer." A bill that was hung up because of the burning crisis that commanded every hotel that fitted sheets for its workers, which, by the way, isn't a bad deal. I think a phase-in period is probably a good thing because there's some interesting long-term health benefits to that. But that's what they're looking at. Instead of, as I said earlier, we were not able to get a constitutional convention, which about a year ago was the talk, 2 years ago, Bachert, Sturmer was leading the fight for it. We can't get that put together. We can't do what was done in the early 1960s in terms of the constitutional revision that was done, because we've got a lack of, dare I say, professional politicians. Okay, who will be around for the long haul.
Well, we've got about a half an hour or so left. Let me throw the audience for questions. You need a microphone, or you can just project.
I can project. One of the great abuses of Prop 13 by the corporations, and I can mention Chase Bank, Ottawa Highlands, and some others, the very, very large corporate owners of huge properties don't, and you alluded to that, don't tend to actually make a title change, they make a stock change. So the abuse is that the property tax rolls don't get updated to the new property. They're still paying, like it isn't when it's the opposite of Google. They'd sell stock, they would sell a building. So that's a way of approaching this.
Well, and that's one of the things I talked about. And that can be done, to be honest with you, with a majority vote in the state legislature. That does not require a two-thirds vote,
well,
because that's administrative change. Well, you know, there are, and being a registered lobbyist, I guess I'm in Sacramento, from as an office there we are, but large corporate interests have registered lobbyists, and they're trying very hard not to allow that to happen. And again, we don't have a seasoned group of professional politicians. You know, Jess Unruh said best, who was one of my mentors and one of my heroes in life. And I'll make this as delicate as I can. But if you can't eat their food, drink their booze, sue their women, and then vote against them, you don't belong here. Well, I dare say of 120 members of the legislature, a lot of them don't belong there.
I wonder, aside from additional revenue, what the effect would be on the economy if you tax the full market value, unimproved or vacant properties, and it's basically just held now for the future of speculation.
Well, first of all, right now, vacant properties are cents on the dollar. I mean, I have numerous companies that can't develop their property right now. Okay, you can't get a bank to finance construction on a vacant property right now. I mean, this is probably the best time to have your property assessed. And if I had a piece of vacant property, I'd be basically, if I haven't had it reassessed, I'd be begging the assessor for the reassessment. I mean, vacant, you know, it's a market situation. I mean, to this point, you know, you have something happening based upon 1978 law that has no application in the current market, you know, market dynamic. You have companies that basically are taking advantage of the fact that they can charge market rents, they can charge us market prices, but they benefit from the fact that they're exempt in a whole different, in a whole bunch of different ways from paying market prices themselves.
Yes. Nobody's talked about the two-thirds piece. You did a little, but I mean, well, what do you think of some of the discussions about lowering it to 55%, or, there's also another movement out there to say basically give the power to local governments to lower their threshold. Yeah, that would sort of, devolve the taxation accountability and capability down to local government.
Well, I'm a maximalist, an infamous maximalist. I fear that all of those proposals, which, I'm sympathetic towards, it's like, essentially what we have, people think, well, if we just, it's that thought process of our politics, if we just pull that one thing out, if we just drop that one supermajority, we got rid of the budget supermajority, and we went down to majority vote, fixed the budget, didn't it? Just, it worked swimmingly this year, right? It was just so honest, except for that extra $4 billion in revenue that just was assumed at the end. I think you should imagine the government of California as the Winchester Mystery House, essentially. All these rooms, it makes no sense, no one knows. So you can add a room through an initiative, maybe you take off a room, but you still kind of got a house that doesn't work. I'm for demolition and redesign. I mean, I think the notion, this is hard. You can hire Harvey, who will tell you this is nuts, that all politics is incremental, that's how change happens. And that is true in 99% plus of examples. But California is the great counterexample to that, because California has never, in 160 years, had a real moment of design where it tried to have election systems that met governing systems like. It's not like us. We've always been in a hurry to get wealthy, get ahead. People coming here from someplace else, that's our thing. And our entire governing structure was built essentially one thing at a time, one silver bullet, one little change that was gonna, if you pull this thing out, it'll get rid of this majority, change this, it'll change the world. And I would submit that our record, that those things never work, that they are actually sort of the poison and the cure, and that some sort of moment of constitutional redesign, whether it's through a convention, a revision commission, or some other process anyone wants to devise that involves everybody, all the dirty interests across, is ultimately what we have to do, as hard as that sounds. And that's actually, and that ultimately, it is easier to fix the system. In fact, it's possible to fix the system that way. Just pulling, one measure, what California Forward's going to do, and a bunch of goo-goos are going to do next year is put up one or two or three initiatives and say this will solve things, and it won't. So I would argue for a different way, a different mindset, a different way of thinking about this problem. It's not about Prop 13 even, but about this whole big mess that we have.
If I can follow up on that, there are two points. So one specifically with the two-thirds issue. One of the first things we all learned on the playgrounds and in classrooms was the term majority rules. We heard this as second graders, and I've personally been one who wants to believe that the two-thirds in any form, other than perhaps presidential, you know, perhaps veto power, I've never liked two-thirds personally, and I believe majority rules. On the issue of grand change, Constitutional Convention Reform Commission, Joseph Stalin once said, I don't care who votes, I care who counts the votes. And the problem with a constitutional convention or reform commission is who is going to appoint the delegates to it. And while I would like to see it occur, who is going to appoint the delegates? And what we may just end up seeing is a smaller or larger version of our legislature, because the odds are those are the people who are going to appoint the delegates.
Yeah. So, though a version of our legislature not constrained by the existing constitution, I would submit that our legislators would do better with less constraints. Yes, they would be awful. They would do many terrible things, but they would not be quite this awful. And I would also point out to you that when you measure the, by almost any independent measure we have, I mean, the simplest ones are sort of education and others, our legislators, this is a terribly impolitic thing to say, and that's why I so enjoy saying it, are our betters. They are better educated, in fact, the best educated legislature in the United States of America. But they are, under our system, they are so constrained, their discretion, they're little more than janitors who sort of pick up on after our constitutional and fiscal messes, which have been made by previous governments and by previous folks. Now, yes, what little discretion they often abuse, but that's the nature of politics. We get all the abuse and none of the good things that can come of politics and discretion in our system.
I mean, at the end of the day, we have no one to blame but ourselves. We basically have 10 minutes, you know, and you have elected officials who are more concerned about the next job than they are concerned about creating change. And it's pretty obvious why the mayor basically promotes Prop 13. He doesn't have a next job. He's turned out 2013. He can go out there and make these bold statements and push his agenda because at this point he doesn't necessarily have the next job. Now, whether he was going to consider, he's going to look at the possibility of a governor run, I doubt it, or an ambassadorial appointment by the president, who knows. But the fact is that it almost takes people who don't have the next job, because even if the legislature did vote for a change administratively, I'm sure there's people out there, including the guys going to run against them for the next job, going to use that against them. As a populist, we almost have to basically, I support the idea that Prop 13 needs to be updated. We all have to, as a populist, decide, you know what, yeah, maybe it's a good idea. Maybe we do need an update, rather than this kind of dogmatic position that says, don't change it. We need to say, you know what, things suck bad enough, and I think most people would argue, yes, they suck bad enough in California, that there needs to be some level of a change. And Prop 13 is kind of central to that change, you know. And why do we have to, as a populace, basically deal with this, you know, this joke of a budget process, this gaming of a budget process, and shifting costs and expenses, and et cetera, while we have, and again, I'm not necessarily anti-corporate, because, you know, we basically work with, you know, banks and corporations, institutions that basically in this economy. But the fact is, there's got to be a fair share. You know, we all, as residents of the San Fernando Valley, if we own homes, we pay our fair share. If we're businesses, we pay our fair share. Everybody needs to pay their fair share, whether a company doing $500,000 a year in Silmar or a company doing $25 million a year in Woodland Hills. And right now, that's not happening. And what's happening is that those companies are basically, you know, convincing the rest of us that somehow some change to Prop 13 is wrong. And so we all decide, you know what, there needs to be a change. And we just need to manage that change. I don't think anybody in his right mind right now is arguing for a removal of Prop 13 on residential properties. No politician in his right mind is saying that. What we are saying at this point is that it has to be an update. It reflects the reality of our current situation, and that somehow contributes to a financial right-sizing of California.
And I need to address that. I just wanted to address the question directly. I mean, I think majority rule would be the better way to go. It fits our sort of election traditions in the country and the state. But I think there has been a bit of a fetish and obsession with what the percentage is, and not enough thinking about who are the tax raisers. In the state, you know, because basically two kinds of people can raise taxes, state legislators and, you know, the citizens of a particular locality by some supermajority. And the people who can't raise taxes on this sort of post-Prop 13 system are the people who should be the ones who are the tax raisers, which are local elected officials. And now you think of local elected officials, I think of the members of the LA City Council, and I feel a chill up my spine when I suggest it. But not all members. There's some good ones. But that's where you have accountability, and that's and in fact, when people talk about the core spending problem in the state, we are not, as a state government, out of line. We're actually one of the lower spending places in the state. Where we're big spenders in California are there are decisions made by local elected officials who never have the discipline of having to set a tax rate and then defend it democratically. Every local official is a spender first in California, and that's where we're most out of line in local government salaries, in benefits and retirement benefits and pensions, and basically, you know, the more likely a category of worker, of public worker, is to have a penis, the more likely, you know, you're going to have a wildly, you know, the biggest kind of spending, the biggest kind of abuse. Because, you know, imagine, you know, would we have giant local pensions if, you know, local government, you know, elected officials were the ones who decided on the tax rates and had set aside the money for those pensions? No. I mean, there's, you know, would we have some of these these bigger spending abuses if those folks had to set taxes? No. They have a great job in the sense that they can say, oh, well, you know, they're short of money, Sacramento didn't give us enough. And we sort of, with Prop 13 and things after it, sort of severed that basic thing. And the great thing about local elected officials is, you know, for the most part, not in big places, but in a lot of smaller communities, you know where they live. You can go to their house without having to get on a plane, which is, you know, if you want to go see your Sacramento people, you have to get on a plane from here. That's just a core democratic principle that Prop 13 violated. And so that I think should be more of a focus than whatever the particular percentage is.
I believe it's true we should have some kind of an update on the property taxes, and I agree with you. But what I'm afraid of is a runaway update. Now, you said 1.5%, that's fine. But then there's such a temptation to say, oh, wait a minute now, we should do something about that also. How do you avoid having them go to the extreme of doing the homes as well?
Corporations don't vote except with money, and people vote. And by the way, Prop 13 was widely outspent when it passed by about 3-1. I don't believe that there will ever be anything that passed in California, and I've been a little long time, so I will say in my lifetime, that will increase residential property taxes above 1%. I do not think the voters will ever do that. And I totally agree with you, because in every tax you've ever seen, once you open a door to raise it, there's a chance that someone else will come in and, you know, before that gate is closed, and will either jimmy the lock so they can open it again or find some other way to increase taxes. Prop 13 was passed in 1978. This is 2011. There hasn't been a change. Maybe it's, again, it's a pattern that Joe doesn't like, but he's a utopian thinker, and I'm an in-the-mud pragmatist. And maybe you put in, maybe it's a constitutional amendment again that says, by the way, 25 or 30 years, we're going to look at it again, or 10 years or 20 years. We're going to look at our, my favorite number, 18. In 18 years, we're going to look at it again, and we're going to see if it needs updating then. I don't think anything should be forever in terms of laws. But is there a chance? There's always a chance.
There's a question in the back.
I hesitate to say who I work for, but I do work for a state assembly member. I work for assembly member Blumenfield, the chair of the budget committee. So this discussion has been long on our minds in many of the meetings that we've held. I've sat through many meetings with people with developmental disabilities and people who need adult day home care and teachers who are worried about where the schools are going to go because of this climate that we are in with taxes and two-thirds of revenue and the political climate of the state that really doesn't trust the electeds. So my question is, what is the political climate for making these changes? I know we had a minor discussion of split roll tax a couple of years ago, and postcards came in organized by, taxpayers or whatever their name is, and we got postcard after postcard. Well, it doesn't really scare us, but I know the number of postcards is going to scare some other members. So how do we actually take this from an intellectual discussion to a boots on the ground? How do we make this happen?
It's happening right now. As more and more of us basically see state services cut, teachers laid off, services cut back, if we begin to know people who are being, last month, there were zero jobs created in the United States. Net zero jobs created, okay? We have 12% unemployment. Everyone thought that recovery was gonna be something of maybe a U, maybe even a lopsided, outside V. And right now it's more like an L, okay? We're all seeing the effects of it, and at some point we're all gonna say, well, wait, hold on a second. We can't continue this way. It's happening right now. The problem is that there's gonna be a lot of pain to get there, okay? We all know somebody who's lost a house through foreclosure, we all know somebody who's unemployed, we all know basically, that's the problem. It's gonna be where we need this now as a relief. And then it's going to happen. But yeah, unfortunately, that's the sad tale of it.
Wasn't there this Unruh poll, USC poll, a couple of days ago in the LA Times, which asked Californians, what do you think the problem is? Is it too much government spending or not enough government spending? And I think it was like 65% of Californians bought the narrative that too much government spending is the cause of the recession. So in this political environment, I don't understand how you can even begin to head a direction.
I can agree. In the last 18 months or 2 years in particular, where we've seen the rise of the Tea Party movement, local as well as the national level, the subject of government spending has been perverted. You look at the Times, the Speaker Boehner, voted for the debt ceiling increase before he was Speaker, and he didn't have any problems with it. When you see Republicans who supported huge amounts of spending without any record to pay for it, the wars that we, however you feel about them, we fought them and we needed to raise taxes to pay for them and we didn't raise taxes. We are in a political era where the average voter, while he didn't particularly like government, understood the role of government, and didn't feel that government was taking advantage of it. We have it differently. I've seen some storyboards or some commercials recently from some groups that showed the difference, and they were very well done, between a government engineer and a private engineer. And the engineer who worked for the city for 25 years, and he and his wife were taking vacations in Hawaii and this, that, and the other. And the government worker who worked in private industry had to go get a second job at a fast food restaurant to make ends meet because his wife lost their job. We're seeing a growing disparity of distrust. Public employee pensions, public employees are not the cause of the problem, but they have not done a very good job in talking about what the problem is. As great a campaign as Barack Obama ran 3 years ago is probably as poor a campaign he has done as the presidential communicator since his election. And what we're seeing is a distrust, a dislike, And I'm not sure the atmosphere exists right now. I would like to see, in my private discussion, people who supported Prop 13, as I did as a Democratic consultant in 1978 with my then wife, who was a school teacher, we both voted yes on Proposition 13. Because we saw that something had to be changed. It was very much of a protest vote. It's got to be changed again. But there aren't enough people having discussions that Joe is talking about, which are particularly critical, about really changing the fundamentals of what we are doing, not just making the incremental changes. And until we can have, to be honest with you, until the parties agree to compromise, I don't know when compromise became a dirty word in politics. I mean, I grew up in the days of Jess Unger, Willie Brown, who knew the compromise, and Ronald Reagan, and on the Republican side, the Paul Friolos, and the Alfonso Bells, and the Republicans who knew the compromise. I don't remember the day that occurred when compromise became a four-letter dirty word. And until we have professional politicians on both sides of the aisle who are willing to come to the middle, and we've just seen the other kind of poll in California, neither member of the party wants compromise. We are, I think mentalists, we have that compromise to have change.
I think the trick of mindset that needs to be changed to your question is, yeah, we're not going to trust politicians. We probably shouldn't trust politicians. I mean, there's a long record of that, and it's in the American culture. I think we actually need to trust ourselves less. That is the trick of the mind, to look at ourselves and recognize that we are part of the problem. And just, the polls are hilarious. I mean, Californians are sort of like, the California electorate is like the worst girlfriend or boyfriend you ever had. I'd love to see an ad along these lines. I mean, she's mad at you all the time, but she can't really tell you what she wants you to do differently to make her happy. And that's essentially what the polls show. There was a poll last year that asked earlier this year that asked about Brown making the tax extensions and asked people if they knew, Californians, if they knew that taxes had been raised in 2009, temporarily. And I think the number was slightly less than 40% knew of the tax increase. But later in the poll, it was nearly 50%, or 10% more, believed the tax had hurt them. Okay, this tax they had not knew about when the poll started. I mean, it's that kind of attitude. I mean, Californians need to be confronted with the fact that they don't know what they're doing. I mean, in polls last year, only 9% of Californians could tell you both where most state government money goes, schools, and where most state revenue comes from, the income tax. And this was a multiple choice. These were two multiple choice questions with only four choices. So people were confident that they knew, and they were wrong. I used to, when I was a cub reporter in Baltimore, I covered this neighborhood where the chemical plants kept blowing up, and a chemical engineer came in to try to stop this from happening. He used to lecture that it's not what you don't know that will kill you, it's what you know that ain't so. And we're, when we go to the polls and vote on initiatives, we're incompetent chemical executives playing with these very dangerous chemicals. We need a different political narrative that treats us as sort of the bumpkins, the fools that we are, and recognize that the politicians are just sort of a slightly higher form of the fools, and that's a much healthier place to be, as strange as it is. I mean, there are other political cultures, other states that have more of an appreciation for the dirtiness, the entertainment, the craziness of politicians. They celebrate it. Texas is like that. But we have this weird, purist, moralistic political culture in this state. It goes back to the same progressives who gave us that politics should be clean and pure. And I would submit that there are some things, sex, politics, that are a little bit better when a little bit dirty. So, and that's the kind of thinking and ethos I think we should try to put out there.
There's a great Mark Twain quote that you should all love hot dogs, but you never want to watch them being made.
Yeah, more questions from the audience. Let's see, the gentleman in front.
I'm curious that what all three of you are essentially advocating is a tax increase. I haven't found any place where a tax increase has solved problems. They have increased revenue for the city. And in light of what your opinion is of legislators, of the dysfunctional voters, I'm curious as to how or what you feel this updating of Proposition 13 will solve.
I think we've got some fundamental things that are not occurring. I can't drive. I have a very low car. I cannot drive my car. I live on the west side. My office is downtown. I cannot drive down Wilshire Boulevard. It used to be one of the premier streets in Los Angeles, from the Beverly Hills City line to downtown L.A., because I will blow out tires and blow out the bottom of my car. And, you know, I know a few L.A. City Council members for over a lot of years, and when I call them up and they say, Harvey, Wilshire Boulevard's on the list, but there's only X number of dollars to repave the streets, and it's going to take something like 19 years to repave every street in Los Angeles because we just don't have the dollars. The reality is, in every business, we know that X dollars get wasted. My advertising agency years ago, there used to be a slogan, it was a slogan in all advertising agencies, that we all knew that 50 cents out of every dollar in advertising was wasted, we just don't know which 50 cents. So if we raise taxes $20 billion, do we know that $5 or $6 billion will probably be wasted? Absolutely. But $14 or $15 or $16 billion are going to go to our schools, are going to go to fix our streets, are going to go to fix our bridges. Do you know how many bridges we have in the United States that have been inspected and are substandard, like I believe it was in Minnesota, the bridge? 1,900 bridges. Now, the sticky fingers may screw up 300 or 400 bridges, but maybe we'll fix 1,500. So it's not going to be 100% fixed. But the reality is we're out of revenue. We are out of revenue. There are a lot of reasons we're out of revenue, whether it's Prop 98 or things like that, but we are out of revenue. And for the most part, we are all paying less taxes in California today than we pay on our incomes as a percentage than we did 20 years ago.
Right now, by some statements, we may have one of the safest big cities in the country. But in California right now, we rank 48th in per capita spending on education. 48th. And we used to be the pride of the nation. We used to have a community college system, a California State University system, and a UC system that was second to none in the country. And it's quickly dropping down. You know, I completely agree. The fact is that we have lots of problems in the state. Not everyone will be resolved with more money. But the fact is that we are quickly, seeing the state rank at the bottom in every, whether it's transportation, education, the one thing we probably do have is probably some of the best prisons in the country.
But overcrowded.
But the fact is that you're exactly right. We've run out of money. If we want to spend our money better, then let's change those who sit in the city council, except for a few maybe. City council. Let's change our county supervisors. Let's change our state legislatures. Let's change our state senators. Let's change our governor. Frankly, when Brown came in and said, we don't want to pay for it, fine, we just won't spend it. And that's what's happening. We don't have it. They're not spending it. And again, individually, any one of us may not be driving down Wilshire Boulevard. Any one of us may not, need the educational system anymore. Maybe our children are off. But this morning, for example, I took my 5-year-old first day of kindergarten, small elementary school. And I'm watching the kindergarten classes get together. And you're seeing 25, 35 kids in a kindergarten class. Now, my little boy has some special needs, so he's in special class. I'm almost thankful for that. How would my kid learn anything in a kindergarten class of 35 kids? Now, we can talk about LAUSD and the problems of LAUSD and administration and districts, but come on, let's be real, okay? You know, they're not spending that much on administrator salaries to the extent that every elementary class that opened up today in the LAUSD system, there's probably not less than 35 kids in that class. That's just ridiculous. That's unsustainable. We're basically end up with a population and a workforce that currently right now in LA, for example, 50% of the kids will not graduate. Will money solve that? Maybe not. Will it impact it? I believe so. There will be some level of impact. And again, it will be us to elect the proper Board of Education, school board to basically impact that. But the fact is right now is that, you know, the shift has, you know, 69% of the property taxes being paid by residential, the rest, a lot smaller portion being paid by commercial property owners. That's unsustainable from a revenue point of view long term.
Briefly, just very briefly, different answer. I actually I don't think I've advocated for a tax increase here, and if I did, I don't mean to leave that impression. I'm arguing for a change in the governance piece of this. The part of Prop 13 that's least offensive to me is the property tax stuff. It's the other governance pieces, the centralization, the two-thirds stuff that I think are bigger and more problematic. I mean, if you made me king, I would actually cut taxes now. I think we're in a bad economic time. But you can't do that in California. You know why? Because it creates huge problems and systemic risk. Because the system, everyone knows that you can't ever go back and raise taxes again in the good times because of the system we have. I mean, I actually think the question of where the taxes should be is not a real question we can answer now because we don't have a system that allows for governance. I mean, you know, it'd be reckless fiscally. It'd be fine in a state where you knew that you could have a majority vote to raise taxes in the future to cut taxes on things that maybe, you know, would, you know, that we want more of now, right? Perhaps income and sales. But you can't do that because, you know, you don't have a governing system that's built to recover that later. But ultimately, I mean, you know, we need big tax changes. I mean, there's certain things we might raise and certain things we might cut that would make more economic sense. But we can't even really do any of that in this system.
And let me vote one thing. A number of studies have come out that the actual per capita taxes paid in California has actually gone down, not got up. Actual per capita. I'm saying population, by population growth, okay, by individual per capita. You know, you or I may be paying more taxes, but by per capita, the state of California hasn't gone up, it's gone down.
It's also involved with what Joe said. Arnold Schwarzenegger became governor because we reduced the vehicle license fee in good times. You know, we need the money, the law automatically allowed it to increase. He was recalled, was recalled for Arnold Schwarzenegger. Remember, that was the flashpoint of the recall election, was the BLF. So we are, you know, we don't want to pay our own way. It's pretty much, we want someone else to pay our way.
Well, I just add real quickly, I think what you said, Ms. Mangler, about our own way, I think that is really what the conflict, or that is what the discussion is about. That's what the Tea Party is about. They're trying to define what is our own way. Because when people say you're not having more money, what they're saying is we're dissatisfied with government. We're dissatisfied with the direction it's going. And I agree with you, it is dysfunctional. I'm not sure if tweaking 13 is one of the remedies, but I admire you for bringing it up, because it is not a positive thing to talk about. Because for a lot of people, and I know several that I'm related to, it's their security. They could not afford their house if the taxes went up.
And I don't want to change what they're paying their residential. Yeah. I don't know anybody who's ever, by the way, advocated. The only people who bring up that point are the people representing the business community who are opposed to a split roll or any updating at all. And what that is a scare tactic, because I have not seen one story, I have not heard one elected official, I have not overheard one bureaucrat ever bring up changing residential property tax.
And the thing about it is, you know, I would hope that we, as a populace, think more of ourselves to fall into that trap. Okay? is to basically swallow hook, line, and sinker. Somebody would want to put ads on the radio or on TV that would make us think that that's automatically the next step. No one suggested it. No elected official. Nobody suggested an increase in, you know, I own a home. I don't want to see my home property taxes go up. Please. Okay, and I bought it in 2003. Okay, so no, I don't want to see it either. So I'd be the last person that basically would encourage that. And I don't see any benefit. Back to the point you said. Basically, we want everyone basically paying their own way. Okay? And there's a whole group of special interests and corporations and and commercial property owners that, frankly, they can't argue that they are. We're paying their way. Or we're suffering from the non-payment of their way.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. So let me thank the panel for a very thoughtful discussion of Prop 13 and the audience as well for a number of very thoughtful questions. If you have other questions, come on down and ask individual panelists. Good night.